Everybody, it's live from NYU. It's Rebooting the News with me, Dave Weiner, and Jay Rosen.
Hi, Dave, and welcome again to the East Village in New York University.
Yeah, we're so cool.
We are.
So, Jay, tell me what's new in the Rebooting the News world this week.
Well, there's usually an obvious first story for us based on our themes and obsessions in this show, and this week is no exception. The big buzz around the rebooted news tech world has been Google Buzz. And so I want to start off talking about that because it is a very interesting episode. My comment on it was slightly from the position of the observer because I never actually activated it. I don't like to do things right away. I'm not actually a first wave adopter. I like to be kind of the one and a half wave or just behind the first wave. But I watch and I listen to what others are saying. So my comment, which was picked up by quite a few on Twitter, was I waited, read the news about Google Buzz, absorbed the accounts and experiences of people I trust, and disabled it before ever opening it. And the main reason I did that was something that you wrote about in your post on it, which was that I don't understand it exactly, but the people that you email the most with were kind of visible to other people in your network. And that was something that I considered to be a complete invasion of privacy. And I could imagine, for example, students that I email with on Gmail looking at a list like that or a ranking like that and misinterpreting it. And I just felt that based on what people had said, and I read quite a few reviews and accounts of Google Buzz, that it wasn't ready for me. That was my main conclusion from watching this thing unfold. And of course, I read what you wrote.
You were very right on. That was totally correct. It was not ready for you. And the concern that you have was a very valid concern, and it's unthinkable that Google actually released this the way they released it. I mean, my opinion of Google has been deteriorating forever. I mean, I had a very, very high opinion of Google, like almost everybody in the blogosphere did. When they first came out, it was like, wow, these guys like really get the web, and they're, you know, doing things that just add value to what we're doing. And, there was like kind of a love affair, you know. And it went up and up and up for a while and then just started gradually deteriorating, which I guess is to be expected. As a company grows in size, they start behaving pretty much like every other company. But this was beyond the pale. I mean, this was like, I mean, you sort of have to ask yourself when you trust a company, because you have to. If you use Gmail, as I think you do and I do,
yes.
You have to sort of, as you're entering an email, you have to sometimes think, well, I wonder if anybody at Google actually is reading this, because, you know, this is about Google, or this is a competitive issue for Google, or I'm emailing with an executive at a competitor to Google, and are they reading this? Well, I think I have to believe they're not reading it, because it wouldn't be email if they did.
Right.
It's sort of like the definition of email, right? Part of the definition of email is who you email with most frequently is none of anybody's business.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And in fact, if somebody looks in your mailbox, your physical mailbox in the physical world, that itself is a crime.
Is it? Yeah. It's probably a federal crime.
I think it is.
It's interfering with the postal.
Yeah.
It's like one of the most serious crimes, as it should be, because, just basic communication is something that we ought to be entitled to.
Your post was called Google Did Something Seriously Wrong. Why don't you just explain for listeners what that seriously wrong was?
Well, okay. So when you started using, I mean, I was in the first wave of Google Buzz users. So I, when they announced it, I shortly afterwards went on to check my email, and there was the, notice there, you've been enabled for Google Buzz. And so I first thought this is really cool, because I had written a piece a couple of days before everybody knew this was coming. Mm-hmm. And my piece said, well, this is what a Twitter competitor would do if it really wanted to, you know, be a Twitter killer, was the term I used. And so I started evaluating it, looking for, you know, did it have a 140 character limit? Did it handle enclosures? I was not thinking at all that there would be any privacy issue whatsoever. But and in fact, I didn't realize that there would be a privacy issue till quite a bit later. The first thing I noticed was that it was flooding my inbox with all kinds of crap.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as soon as I published something, every reply to that thing that I published was treated as a first-class mail message in my inbox, which I felt was like, holy, you know, this is like exactly what I don't want in my mailbox.
That was another thing that made me wait.
Totally. I kind of at that point said, I think I need to wait here because this isn't how I use email. I mean, email for me, it's like, and I felt this was a breach of trust right there, because part of why I use Gmail is because they have such good spam protection there.
Right.
They keep the crap out of my mailbox. And here they were. I describe this as like a vacuum cleaner that's been turned into reverse. Instead of sucking the dirt out of my room, it's pushing the dirt into it, you know. I go, this is crazy. This is the bizarro world Gmail, you know. Remember the bizarro world from Superman where everything is like backwards?
Well, my son calls it opposite day.
Okay. Well, your son is very astute. He's probably could get a job at Google designing software. So it was later that it came out that there was the privacy concern. So basically what happened when I don't know exactly when in the process it happened that I revealed who I email the most with, okay? But I do know for a fact that I did reveal it. My guess is that I never specifically said I wanted to do it, although Google has thrown a lot of crap at this, and it's gotten quite confusing as to whether or not I did, because who has a perfect memory of what the implications were of all the things that I was doing when I was... See, the assumption, Jay, as I think that this is what you're saying, is that when I'm evaluating a piece of software, I want to feel like that's a safe thing to do, right?
Right.
So, you know, it's a new piece of software. I haven't entered any data into it yet.
Right.
So how could I reveal anything?
Right. Well, there has to be a play space where the consequences aren't real.
That's right. Where there are no consequences, basically.
Right.
That all, you know, or where I'm fully aware of what I'm doing as opposed to only peripherally aware. I think I was in a unique position because I had accepted their invitation to create a profile months and months and months ago. Because
I have a Google profile
time ago. Okay, yeah. My understanding then is if you had already had a Google profile and you were a Buzz user, that means you revealed the people you email the most.
That's why I never opened it.
Without any choice, without ever being asked whether or not you wanted to do it or not.
Yeah.
And the question then comes up is, okay, so that's what happened.
I mean,
basically, if you used Buzz... And I have to say, this is my understanding of it. I am not an expert in Buzz, and I don't want to become an expert in Buzz. I don't think that to test out a piece of software, one should need to become an expert. If you had to become an expert, then nobody would ever test software, because how do you become an expert if you don't test it, right?
Plus, email is the least expertise required program there is. It's the most universally used application.
It's hard to think of anything that would require less. I mean, yes.
So let's talk about Google's response, because this was a case where they were trying to kind of catch up to social media, but social media caught up with them.
Not really. I mean,
well,
in a way it did, but the old media got in the way of this conversation. I mean, that's why it's an appropriate topic for the show, because this plays out in the New York Times. That's where this thing plays out. It doesn't play out in social media. Ultimately, they're going to be the arbiters of what happens here. And if they let Google off the hook, Google's off the hook. I mean, it seems to me that way.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you. They're watching reactions online.
Yes, but their reaction has been to issue a non-apology apology. I mean, you compare this to other industries and how the press has treated them. If Toyota, for example, they didn't say that safety experts are concerned that Toyota has a privacy flaw, or what would be the equivalent of a privacy flaw. They say basically they report the news as people are dying using Toyota cars, mm-hmm. right? Because that is the story, okay? When the Luger died in the Vancouver accident a few days ago, just before the Olympics started, they didn't use a lot of weasel words in their article about it. They said basically, you know, this is what happened. The guy died. They didn't say, according to privacy experts, somebody might die or something. They were very firm and concrete. But when they report what happens with Google, they report their non-apology as an apology. Mm. They said, Google said, we're sorry because people were concerned.
Right. So what should Google have said and done?
There should have been a real apology. We're sorry for violating our users' privacy. Mm-hmm. And here are the steps that we're taking to make sure this doesn't happen again. And here are our ground rules. And this is how you can trust us, because we will not violate these rules.
Okay. What is it you think?
And by the way, one more thing. That should not have come from a product manager. That should have come from an officer of the company. Yeah. It should have come from somebody who has legal fiduciary responsibility for the company. The apology so far has come from an employee.
I think this was
which
one
is meaningless,
for Schmidt to take himself, myself, my own
view. Of course. The CEO is the guy who has to take it. And look at Toyota, for example. I mean, they had, if you go look and see their apology, the one that they're paying, that they're running in ads, they're paying to have the apology run. Mm-hmm. They don't mince any words. Mm-hmm. We screwed up. We apologize. We hope to regain your trust.
All right.
Look at Johnson & Johnson with Tylenol. Look at all these cases. The tech industry has yet to learn how to be a responsible member of the society that's part of.
What was Google trying to do with Google Buzz?
Good question. Really good question. I don't think it is what people have said it is, that it was an – I don't think it was a mistake. I think they knew what they were doing. I think that that their goal was to catch up as quickly as they possibly could to Facebook. I think that Twitter wasn't the issue. Facebook was the issue. And the reason why was that Facebook is getting ready to launch a product, a new product, that is an email, webmail application that's linked into your Facebook account. And it's going to be a really great product. Mm-hmm. And because when you go that route, when you go from a social application, a social web like Facebook, and add email to it, mm-hmm. that actually works. Because what you're doing is you're taking a network that you created in the social context and simply applying that. Now all of a sudden you've got the email addresses of the people you're friends with. So I can say, you could send email to those people before using Facebook. The only difference is now it looks and feels more like email, and you have the ability to email to people who are not members of Facebook.
So they see Facebook, a very powerful social platform, going email, and they say, we are email, we have to go social.
Well, I think, yes, that was their tactic. That wasn't the big picture. The big picture was we are having our lunch eaten here. Mm. There are some various one important statistic number changed is that Facebook now drives more traffic to websites than Google does.
Yeah, to news. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, tell you what, that's got to be a really huge sobering number for Google to parse.
Yeah.
That means their future, that means their advertising revenues are threatened. And so they have to come back no matter how they possibly, and they have to respond to that. And this is an interpretation. I don't know it for anything of a fact, but it's an interpretation. Is they said, you know what? We're just going to use our users. We don't care. We'll lose some users. There'll be some complaints, but that's just the cost of doing business. Mm. Our real problem is the way I look at it is we have lost the war in the social media space, and now we have to do whatever we can to dig our way out of this hole and sacrifice the users, throw them over. This is the way board meetings go in Silicon Valley, Jay. I mean, they ask, if somebody says, well, what about the users? Oftentimes it's just laughter. Nobody really cares about the users.
You know? Well, another way to interpret it would be, I've always felt that Google's mission to organize the world's information, as they say, is a good guide to understanding that company. So,
but this isn't what that is anymore.
Well, what they were saying is we are losing our central place in organizing the world's information.
Yeah.
we are not going to be the way the world does that if we don't get going here.
No matter how you look at it, it has a real feel of an act of desperation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. I mean, I don't love Facebook. I have no strong feelings for Facebook whatsoever. I'd like to see these guys compete on a level playing field and earn and work for the user's trust and to delight the users. Unfortunately, I don't think the users really matter to them all that much.
Mm.
That's the sad situation we're in.
All
That's
right.
why the open web is so important, Jay. That's why the open web is so vital.
Yeah, well, this is
it's where
a point
we
have
ourselves.
Come back to again and again.
Absolutely.
Because you're right. The mysteries of trust repay close examination.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're dealing with an application like email, it's, as you said earlier, Dave, the level of trust that you actually have to have on a company to use it like we do for private email is basically total. I mean, there isn't anything about my life that isn't in my email box, you know? And I am giving it all to Google in some way. And even if I don't think about it every day, and even if I do trust, the level of dissatisfaction or anxiety that can be created by screwing up with trust is so huge that it's what the lawyers almost call an enterprise-threatening event.
Enterprise. Oh,
look, it's a term. It just means something that is.
I just knocked a wire out. That's okay. Sorry, I'm okay. Go ahead.
An enterprise threatening event is something that's so big it could sink the company.
Right. So you're talking about Google then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost at the level of an enterprise threatening event in the sense that when you get to user trust, you're dealing with the entire company.
Yet this is why it's this is why I don't understand why the mainstream press isn't treating this as a big story, you know, because it is a big story. You know, this is look at the way this company is running right now and look at the reckless thing that they just did. You know, they have lawyers at Google, right, Jay? And you know that they have to go through those lawyers to release a product.
Sure.
There's no way they didn't know up front that they were doing this with their users, and there's no way that they didn't focus group test this with their users and come up with some kind of an estimate for how many users they would lose. I mean, they probably hired a management consulting firm to study this exact subject. This is such a vital question.
Well, we don't have any way of knowing that, but I see what you mean.
But companies like that don't move without really understanding the ramifications of what they do. Yeah. Anyway, we can move on.
Let's move on to our next item. We both use this very effective application that you came up with, the 40 Twits app, which tells us how many clicks we get on various links we send out through Twitter. And for most of the week, the top link on my list was this little item that appeared in The Guardian about the BBC. And what it said was essentially that the BBC had an internal communication told its news staff that they have to get on board with the rebooted system of news. They have no choice. It was kind of in the guise of a social media policy, but it was really beyond that. They were saying to their people, the news moves in a very different way now. And we have always thought of ourselves as making programs.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of thought that we could continue to just make programs and, use Twitter and use Facebook and put our programs on different platforms. And what the bosses of the BBC were saying to their editorial staff in this memo was, actually, it's gone way beyond that. And the way that news moves is completely reconfigured, and we don't have any choice, and you don't have any choice. And we have to not only use these tools, we have to begin integrating them in the way that we gather news and listen to the world and produce our stuff, and even to the point of breaking down the program as the production god in our routines, which is going pretty far, right? And I just want to read a bit of this memo where these executives say, this isn't just a kind of fad from someone who's an enthusiast of technology. I'm afraid you're not doing your job if you can't do these things. It's not discretionary, he was quoted as saying in the BBC In-House Weekly.
Who is this saying that?
This is Peter Horrocks, who is the director of BBC Global News. And we're hearing about an internal communication, like in a company newsletter,
mm-hmm.
that's going out as an advisory to the people who do news. And he says that Twitter and RSS readers are essential tools. Aggregating and curating content has to become part of how you do your work.
Yeah.
It's not enough to occasionally hear from a listener. We have to begin to integrate voices from the outside into what we do.
That is amazing.
And listen to this. The final or wrap-up for the memo is, if you don't like it, if you think that level of change or that different way of working isn't right for me, then go and do something else because it's going to happen.
Yeah. So the only thing he's wrong about is that, not that it's going to happen, but it has
already happened. Has happened.
Yeah.
But what he's saying is, if these tools aren't for you, if the rebooted system for news is not one in which you can see yourself working,
yeah.
go somewhere else.
Yeah. Well,
that's kind of amazing, don't you think?
It is totally. I would say it's a milestone for sure. I mean, the argument still goes on inside of newspapers and journalism schools. You know, there are a lot of people who are still shoveling, you know, trying to shovel that pile back into the hole that just got vacated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're trying to fill that thing back up. It's the wrong question, of course. You know, let's try to make it work in the new context. You know, I was talking with Cody Brown yesterday, and I was looking at his new product, Commons, thing that he's working on.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. I have to get a demo.
Well, good. I would say you should get a demo. I think it's a really interesting product. It's nicely designed. And so we were talking afterwards, and, you know, I was saying basically, you know, why don't you apply this to NYU Local? Because NYU Local looks like a real, to me, looks like a success. And he said something that was kind of similar to what you're describing there. He said, well, it's not good enough. I mean, basically, we've got 20 people at NYU Local, which I think is an amazing accomplishment that he's got.
That's 20. A lot, yeah.
Yeah, it's a huge number of people. You know, to get that number of people contributing editorially for free, basically, as a labor of love, is significant. But he said, no, that's not the problem. The problem is, you know, there are X number of thousand people. How many students are there at NYU, Jay? It's like 10,000?
More than that?
Yeah. Okay.
So closer to 20,000.
Let's say 20,000 students. He says, well, we've got 20 out of 20,000.
Mm-hmm.
And look at how much news there probably is actually going on at NYU. And we're catching a very, very, very small portion of that. And that's true. And, you know, at the same time, you look at these, news organizations like the Times, for example, talking about putting up a paywall to try to, and of course that acts as a regulator. It will, you know, decrease the amount of news that gets read, right? Meanwhile, really the problem isn't to extract money out of the flow that they've created. Rather, the challenge is to try to figure out how to expand the flow to cover all the stuff that's now relevant, and it's possible. The BBC guy is much closer, although still very far away from where they need to be, which is he's on the path to creating a news system that really can get into all the nooks and crannies,
mm-hmm.
and get every piece of news that, you know, I mean, this came up. I had breakfast this morning with Jeremy Zeiler of the New York Times.
Oh, yeah?
And we
cool.
And we were talking about this stuff, and I drew a little curve showing, you know, this is the demand for news, right? And, you know, it's obviously going up over time. It's probably like a 45-degree curve, you know,
mm-hmm.
meaning that it's like, for every change in time, there's an equivalent increase. Who knows? Whatever. It's a pretty steep curve. And he said, well, you know, sooner or later, people's attention span is going to become the issue. And I said, no, that's not what I mean. because maybe the attention span even stays constant. The problem is, the reason why there's so much demand for so much more news is because people want more specific news applying to the life that they're living.
Right.
So the demand for overall news goes up, even if the attention span doesn't do anything. Of course, the ability to consume news, what this guy's talking about, well, he's got Twitter and he's got RSS readers. What do those things do other than they make news more efficient? They make the news reading experience
right.
more efficient. Means you can read more news.
Right.
You know, and that was it. Like the promise of RSS was never that you were going to spend less time reading news. It was just that you were going to get more news, right? You're going to be able to pipe more in. So
yeah.
you need to reach into all those nooks and crannies, which means the editorial tools need to improve too.
Right.
Which is something that isn't necessarily in his equation, but young Cody Brown, brilliant young man that he is thinking about this.
Well, yes.
And this is where we need to be thinking. We need to be thinking, how do we create these tools that enable individuals whose first impulse isn't necessarily to report news, to give it, to make it really easy, almost
right.
inevitable that they do report it. And of course, Twitter has made a big contribution there, too.
Yeah, let me jump in here. What I found so striking about this report from inside the BBC was that he had zeroed in on the key problem, which is an entire generation of journalists, several generations,
yeah.
had grown up bending their skills and focusing their minds on a particular problem, which is the production of programs. And in the newspaper biz, it's the production of the paper. They still call it the paper
right.
at the New York Times, for example.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because you can organize everything around this one challenge, which is to get the paper out. In television, it's the 6 p.m. broadcast, right? And what the BBC guy was really saying, what Cody is saying, is if you look at the entire system of news, we have to ask ourselves, how well is that system working? Because any individual journalist isn't doing any better than the system as a whole is doing.
Yeah.
And this way of thinking about news, of kind of taking the entire system, connecting the users to the journalists, the network to the event, right, the community to social media,
yeah.
the flow of news as opposed to the newscast,
right.
kind of redefining journalistic work within this entire system,
yes.
that
yes,
is,
that's
why I keep talking about the rebooted system
right.
of news,
right.
because we have to bring the consciousness of that entire system into the way individual journalists, editors, reporters work. And it's a huge task. Part of it is conceptual.
Yeah.
But it's also coming up with new routines, new tools, and a different kind of
social
awareness.
I want to add something to that. It's not just the new tools, too. It's also understanding how it was done in the past. I almost wrote a piece this week, but decided that it was a little too difficult to write. But I keep using the New York Times as an example, but I'm going to do it again. I think they ought to write a book that says, this is how you write for the New York Times. And so that I can read it, and you can read it. And,
okay.
And but more important, Jay, your students can read it. And their family can read it. And a kid can read it when he's in sixth grade. You know, even though, you see what I'm getting at? Is like, let's
I
document.
I do. It's an item on my list here.
It is?
Yeah.
You want to do this? Or you want them to do it?
No. Here's what I mean. I've been talking to you about the open source assignment desk, right? We've mentioned it like 4 or 5 times.
Right.
And Studio 20, along with the computer science program here at NYU, is going to actually try and build this thing. So it's a project that's going forward. And it has different parts. One of them is, if you're a contributor, you can log in to the assignment desk and see what's available as assignments. And another part is, if you're an editor, you can kind of see, like, here are the assignments that are out and when they're coming back. And that's just a workflow system, that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Another part of it is, if you have something that we should cover or should be covered by someone, enter it here, and it goes kind of into the queue, right? But the most interesting part of it to me is that when you enter into the open source assignment desk and you get an assignment, it should also give you simple instructions for how you complete that assignment. And these instructions are, how do you write the news? How do you report an event?
Mm-hmm.
How do you come back from a community board meeting, let's say, with an account of that meeting for the San Francisco Chronicle, for the Boston Globe, for WNYC, right? And if we can get better and better at delivering instructions that make it easy for people to produce solid accounts that others in the community can use, if we become efficient, extremely efficient, at distributing those instructions, right, to the people who can use them, if we put some effort into refining and perfecting those instructions so that we know from the user's point of view they work. Oh, that was really helpful. That helped me write my post, right?
Yes.
If we can kind of engineer it so that really effective methods for instructing people in how to come back with a competent account are spread to, you know, more and more sites so that people know what best practice is, then I think the efficiency that we're looking for become possible. This has never been really done because professionals wanted to keep instructions for how to produce accounts to themselves, right? Because they are the ones who produce.
I think that might be half of it. I think the other half of it is that if we actually saw their recipe, we might, you know, get nauseous. You know, there are some really weird things that they do in these reports.
True, and they wouldn't necessarily withstand scrutiny.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you listen to, like, an NPR report, you know, they send somebody out, you know, somewhere around the world to do a report on something, and there is a formula that they're using. I mean, you can feel it. You can hear it. And the formula says something like this, is that the listener doesn't have your eyes, so you have to paint a picture for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do that. They are very descriptive of what they're seeing, mm-hmm. but it often is very trite and very superficial.
Well, what I mean by instructions is not necessarily reproducing the existing forms.
Right. I understand. Yeah. That's why, but I'm saying that's why they may not want to.
Sure.
Because who wants to read that, or who wants anybody to read that?
Well, there's an element of maintaining a mystique that they don't want
to. I know. Yeah. I'm saying that that there's both sides to it. It's sort of like their dirty laundry that they may not
want to. Yeah, there's a backstage part to it that they don't necessarily want to reveal, but my sense of instructions is these are instructions that we are comfortable releasing because they work and they help people.
I still think that there's a need for an introductory class to journalism, a one semester thing you can do that you could take that a computer science student. This might be something you could do reciprocal for the computer science department, just off the top of my head, is that while they're creating tools for you to use, you could create a checklist for what does a computer science student need to know in order to be a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you'd start getting reports coming from inside of the machine as opposed to these sort of superficial.
Yeah.
I think the reason why going back to the original piece about, you know, the story about Buzz, I think the reason why the Times tiptoes around these things is because they feel that these are complicated technical subjects, but they don't feel competent to talk about technology. The answer to that is give the tools of reporting to the technologist. You know, you've heard me say this a million times.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this part of it, but
why not?
Well, I don't.
Well, I am.
Okay, all right, you are.
FYI,
no, I'm not.
I'm absolutely sure you need to bring you need to teach the person inside to communicate with the outside world.
I like that idea. I think that journalism schools should develop extension models. And this is something that I certainly want to work on here at NYU and begin to teach non-journalists how to report. I think
this is your whole mission eventually. I think right now it's your whole mission, actually. You know, it's part of the rebooted system. It's the sources go direct. This is the implementation.
Right, I understand.
Yeah,
I understand. I think at the center of it is an idea that we don't go directly at enough. The most important thing that journalism and journalism schools, professional journalists could teach the wider world is the very basic idea of the report.
Yeah.
What is a report?
Yeah.
And the essence of it starts, as I think I've said before in this program, with I'm there, you're not, here's the account, or I checked it out, you didn't have time to, here is my report, or I talked to the guy, you weren't able to talk to the guy, here is my report. And
wait, let me add one more to it. I've spent a lifetime studying this.
Yeah, I've.
You haven't.
Here's my report. Exactly.
And that one to me is the one that's discredited in the old system.
Not to me.
I know, not to you. But I'm saying in general.
Sure.
Well, you know too much. You could never explain it. Well, with a little bit of practice of explaining your craft to people who are not familiar with it, anybody can explain what they do.
I think that is a skill, and a lot of specialists lack it, but it's a developable skill. Yeah,
right. Maybe not for everybody. There probably are some people with learning disabilities who are perfectly capable of living inside the mind of a computer who can't explain that to somebody who does not live inside the computer. But I think that's a bad excuse for most people can do that.
Well, I don't know about most people, but it is certainly possible. And I've spent a long time studying this. You haven't. Let me tell you about it. Is the basis of a report.
Yeah. And can we get that? Let's get a checklist for that. Let's start working on that. I want to talk a little bit about the Thursday meetups that we're going to have here.
Yeah, sure.
Because almost anybody that's made it this far into the podcast who's in New York would be totally welcome.
Let's announce them.
Yeah. So every Thursday evening at 7 o'clock, I'm going to lead a discussion here at NYU. At NYU. at 20 Cooper Square on the 7th. Is it on the 7th or the 6th? 7th floor. The classroom's on the 7th
floor. Classroom is 6th floor.
6th floor, exactly.
Yeah,
it's going to be on the 6th floor. And it's going to be patterned after the Thursday evening meetings we were doing at Berkman. I was doing at Berkman when I was a fellow there. The mission is still as yet to be determined. The mission at the Berkman meetups was to get a blogging community started in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and we succeeded at doing that, and the method for doing that was pretty much very straightforward. You know, blogging tutorials started each session for the first 6 months and were always part of every, you know, we never stopped doing that because there were always newcomers coming in, and it always benefited the established bloggers to watch a newcomer learn this. This was always part of the process. When we did BloggerCon came out of the Thursday evening meetings. It was a natural outgrowth. It was like, okay, we now understand what we want to do. Now how do we spread the gospel? How do we get more people to do it? So BloggerCon became the answer to that. And even at BloggerCon, we had, you know, a dedicated track just for teaching people how to blog.
Mm-hmm.
So tentatively in my mind, what I've had about the mission here would be to get something like the HyperCamp idea booted up so that you'd have a venue for informal product discussions so people could come and bring their products or services or editorial ideas or whatever, half-baked, fully-baked, whatever state they're in, bring your ideas, we'll talk about them. But I think that maybe one of the other missions here ought to be to do this business about teaching people how to be reporters. You know, that
this ought to... I like your idea of media hacking. I think it should be about that.
Well, it certainly will be about that.
I think that's a very useful notion.
Interesting. Because we're trying to come up with a name for it too. At the first meeting, we're gonna talk
media
about
hacking that. Media hacking has legs.
Yeah, media hacking's good. Yeah. I was thinking Fight Club for tech.
almost I like
all
media hacking.
Jay, I know, but you see, the thing is, almost all the young people really like the Fight Club thing, and the young person inside of me likes it too, because it says basically, if you, I mean, the Fight Club idea was, we're just going to, because we like to fight. It's like, we're going to come. And, well, anyway, it's a long story. Anyway, if you want to participate in this, send me an email, dave.weiner@gmail.com, and I'll get you instructions on how to be there. And the first meeting is day after tomorrow.
And Studio 20 is sponsoring this series of meetings because we think it's important to make NYU a place where people at the intersection of journalism and technology and media hacking, which means improvising the new system of news because it's up to us to build it,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
Can get together and hear about new ideas and create kind of a forum where instead of thinking about these things in our own individual minds, we can put our minds together. And I won't be able to be there every night, but I will be there some of the time. And some of the students who are associated with Studio 20, I think, will want to join. And this is why we brought Dave in as a visiting scholar, to do things like this. And I think there is a constituency, a growing constituency of people in New York City who sense that something's fermenting out there, and some of them will probably show up as well. So I think it's going to be a cool thing.
Yeah, we'll have fun. Cool. Thank you, Jay, by the way, for your support of this. Much appreciated.
Absolutely. We have about three or four minutes left. What should we tackle?
That's a good one. What's on your list?
Well, there was one more item on my list, and I wrote about it this week at my posterous, and I just want to sort of get this off my chest.
That's
a good one. It's probably going to provoke you as well, but I'm just really, really tired, and perhaps you can hear in my voice just how
tired I am
of people denouncing claims that, as far as I can tell, were never made. And the one I wrote about this week was the claim that the crowd is all wise, or crowd or collective wisdom can replace the wisdom of an individual. And I see lots of people rushing to disagree with this notion and denounce this notion and distance themselves from it and warn about it, using incredibly irresponsible phrases like digital Maoism for the so-called believers in this idea. And I continuously ask people who are eager to debunk this notion, where is this notion found? Who actually says crowds are all wise? Who actually has tried to put together a even halfway serious argument that the crowd wisdom is going to replace the individual mind? I mean, it's a piece of crap. And, you know, what you do with pieces of crap is you flush them away.
That's very colorful.
You don't write books about them. And
you're thinking of Jaron Lanier, right?
Well, I mean, the idea of calling people who are enthusiastic about social media or open source or whatever, and or maybe overly enthusiastic, Maoists, is associating them with a mass murderer. Don't you think that's a bit over the top?
It's way over the top, and I feel exactly the same way.
I mean, you have some disagreements with people within the tech world about how enthusiastic they ought to be about some of these things and what's being lost when these new tools are brought online. Fine. That's part of normal discourse.
I still found, you know, I heard Jaron, I assume the term digital Maoism came from Jaron Lanier. And I heard Jaron interviewed on Point with Tom Ashbrook.
60 seconds.
And I think I understood what he was saying, and I agreed with most of it, what Jaron was saying. And I also listened to the way that interview was conducted. I'm just giving you the counterpoint. And they are incapable of subtlety in that medium. You know, the NPR interview is a very superficial, and that's the most in-depth interview process we've got, right? One of them. And so he was doing the best he could, but I agree with you totally. And it's a
digital Maoism. It's an obscenity.
It's pretty bad. You know, it's like being called an idealist. You know, I've had that label thrown at me, and I sure.
No, it's
shoulders.
Like being called an open source Hitler.
Okay, I think on that note, on the open source Hitler, I think that's a good closer for our week.
Dave, it's been a pleasure, and this NYU thing is hot.
Yeah, live from NYU, it was Rebooting the News. Good night.